From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, U.S. releases torture report on CIA interrogation methods. The U.N. reports new pledges to help Syrian refugees. The Russian president is to visit India for a day summit. Some people exposed to Ebola only become mildly ill, if at all. And Britain's Prince William accuses wildlife poachers of looting the planet. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The U.S. Senate has released a highly critical report detailing how the Central Intelligence Agency used harsh interrogation methods on suspected terrorists in the aftermath of the September 11, 2001 attacks on the United States. VOA's Sharon Bain has details.
During the release of the report detailing harsh interrogation techniques used by the CIA, Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Dianne Feinstein said the agency violated U.S. law and values. She defended the release of the report about the use of coercive interrogation techniques on at least 119 individuals detained by the intelligence agency from late 2001 to January 2009.
History will judge us by our commitment to a just society governed by law and the willingness to face an ugly truth and say never again.
The report says the CIA used waterboarding, mock executions, ice baths, sexual threats, and other harsh interrogation techniques against captured al-Qaeda and other militants to obtain information. One detainee died in 2002 after being chained partially nude to a concrete floor. Charles Allen, the former assistant director of the CIA who managed the intelligence community's collection programs from 1998 to 2005, was present when the decision was made to use the harsh techniques. Allen told VOA he understood the techniques and procedures that were going to be used, but thought they were needed at the time.
I was at the small group. I was at the table. I could have had reservations. But the pressure on us and our determination to get back at al-Qaeda and get inside and dismantle and destroy it were really overwhelming.
The report also says CIA managers failed to take appropriate or corrective action after the death and injury of CIA detainees, the detention of individuals who did not meet the legal standard to be held, and the use of unauthorized interrogation techniques. U.S. diplomatic, military, and business interests abroad are gearing up for a possible violent backlash to the report on the CIA's activities, many of which took place at so-called black sites or secret prisons overseas. U.S. President Barack Obama pointed out in a statement that no nation is perfect. But one of the strengths that makes America exceptional is our willingness to openly confront our past, face our imperfections, make changes, and do better. Among those subjected to the techniques in various black sites were top al-Qaeda operatives Abu Zubaydah and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the planner of the October 2000 bombing of the USS Cole, Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri. According to the 500-page summary of a longer 6,700-page document, the CIA's interrogation methods failed to produce any life-saving intelligence. It says the agency provided inaccurate information on the effectiveness of its program. Current CIA Director John Brennan admitted in a statement that the agency made mistakes and did not always live up to the high standards expected by the American people. But he insisted the interrogations did produce intelligence that helped thwart attack plans, capture terrorists, and save lives. Feinstein said a small number of people in the CIA were involved in the brutal interrogation methods, developed and led by two outside contractors with little effective oversight. The program was authorized by former President George W. Bush in the aftermath of the September 11, 2001 attacks that killed nearly 3,000 people. President Obama banned the techniques when he took office in 2009. The senior National Security Counsel at U.S.-based Human Rights Watch, Laura Pitter, welcomed the report.
It was important for the U.S. to acknowledge wrongdoing, understand what happened, and hopefully these are the first steps towards some kind of accountability.
CIA veteran Jose Rodriguez ran the interrogation program and said it was judged legal at the time by the Justice Department. Writing in the Washington Post newspaper, Rodriguez stated, "We did what we were asked to do. We did what we were assured was legal, and we know our actions were effective. He said information obtained through the enhanced interrogation program helped lead to the capture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the self-proclaimed architect of the September 11 attacks. Former Vice President Dick Cheney also has defended the program and those who ran it, telling the New York Times newspaper it kept the country safe from more mass casualty attacks. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Washington.
The United Nations says member states have agreed to take in more than 100,000 Syrian refugees from neighboring host countries, doubling previous resettlement offers. The announcement by UN Refugee Chief Antonio Guterres Tuesday comes hours after a donor country conference in Geneva, in which he repeated a plea for increased international collaboration to resettle Syrians fleeing a civil war and the encroaching Islamic State militant group.
Today, 28 countries express their solidarity with the Syrian refugees, but also with the five neighboring countries that are hosting them, Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, Iraq, and Egypt, offering what we estimate will be more than 100,000 opportunities for resettlement and humanitarian admission.
Earlier, Guterres said the long-term goal is for non-neighboring countries to welcome 10% of the estimated 3 million Syrian refugees abroad. According to the UN, the majority of the states that offered to accept refugees on Tuesday are from the European Union. Russian President Vladimir Putin is visiting India for one-day annual summit that will seek to reinvigorate a once-close relationship that has lost some of its spark in recent years. As Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi, the visit will focus on deepening energy and trade ties.
Out of the dozen or so agreements that New Delhi and Russia are expected to sign Thursday, the most significant could be potential deals for joint exploration of oil and natural gas in Siberia. In an interview to an Indian daily, the Russian president said, "We expect to secure ourselves the role of a reliable energy supplier to Asian markets." On its part, energy-starved India wants to diversify its oil suppliers, which mostly come from the Middle East. Bharat Karnad is a strategic analyst with New Delhi's Center for Policy Research.
They need commitments, especially on the oil investments and in increasing Indian oil investments, which for Russia, you know, the energy sector is the economic driver there. So these are the sorts of things that the Russians are looking for, to regain their lost confidence in New Delhi.
Faced with Western-led sanctions, Russia is turning to Asia for more trade and investment. And as they prepare for the summit, the allies from the Cold War days are both stressing their commitment to do more business and transform the relationship that has sagged in recent years. President Putin called India a reliable and time-tested partner. Indian officials underlined New Delhi's commitment to its long-standing partner. Joint Secretary in India's Foreign Ministry, Ajay Bisaria, says bilateral trade at $10 billion is far below potential and efforts will be made to increase it.
India has said clearly that it cannot be party to any economic sanctions against Russia. President Putin's visit is a landmark event and is expected to provide a fresh impetus to the existing excellent bilateral relations between our countries.
New nuclear plants to be built by Russia, an oil and gas pipeline between the two countries, the sale of Russian rough diamonds directly to India for cutting and polishing, and building advanced weapons will be on the agenda. Observers say Russia is irked that India is increasingly turning to Western suppliers, including the United States, for its military equipment. India is downplaying such concerns, saying Russia is also New Delhi's primary defense partner and will remain so for decades. President Putin said that the high level of trust allows the two countries to make the transition from selling weapons to joint development and production of advanced weapons systems. Russia also sought to dispel Indian fears on a military cooperation pact Moscow inked with India's arch-rival Pakistan last month, with Russian ambassador to New Delhi saying that Moscow will never do anything to harm India's security interests. Commentators have noted that President Putin's visit comes ahead of another high-profile visit, that of U.S. President Barack Obama, who comes to India in January as the chief guest for the country's Republic Day celebrations. That visit is seen as a signal of efforts being made by Prime Minister Narendra Modi to raise ties with Washington. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Although the Ebola outbreak is far from contained, researchers are working diligently to find ways to slow transmission rates, including finding a vaccine. One line of scientific inquiry involves looking into why some people who are Ebola-infected never get sick, a phenomenon known in scientific circles as asymptomatic Ebola infection. Steve Bellin, a researcher at the University of Texas at Austin, recently co-authored a study published in the Lancet Journal on these cases in which a person has been exposed to Ebola but became only mildly ill or not at all. Bellin spoke about the results with VOA's Catherine Maddox.
So what we did was we did a review of all evidence to date that Ebola infections can be asymptomatic. That is, that people can be exposed to the virus, develop an infection, but never know it because their body successfully fights it off. And there actually is substantial evidence that this happens relatively frequently, particularly from one study of an outbreak in Gabon in 1996. Where they did a lot of virological and immunological work, so looking at both to see whether they could find the virus in people that never became sick and also whether those people mounted immune responses, and they found both. Very, very tiny levels of virus for a very short amount of time, and then right when the virus disappeared, their immune response kicked up. So sign of a clear asymptomatic infection, and their immune response may indicate that they actually develop protective immunity. And here's the key distinction. The fact that someone develops an immune response shows that they were exposed to the virus, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they are immune.
Right.
If they were exposed again, they might successfully fight it off and they might not. And we don't really have enough evidence to know whether it is protective yet. It's, of course, a very difficult thing to study because it means somebody has to have been exposed twice.
Right.
And you have to know that they were exposed the first time, even though they didn't even become sick.
What level of population in the current outbreak in the three hotspots in West Africa? Is there a sense or any kind of information that there may be a percentages in those three countries that are asymptomatic?
So I think we're, for the most part, too much in outbreak mode and prioritizing things that really need to be prioritized, like treating infected individuals and finding their contacts and treating and isolating them as soon as they get sick, if they do get sick. And I think, you know, people are starting to think about looking at this, but it still is quite early. I wouldn't be surprised if studies start coming out looking at the proportion of asymptomatic or the proportion of infections that are asymptomatic. Of course, to do this, you have to be collecting blood from people in outbreak settings, which has its own risk, right? So you need to balance the benefits with the costs. And these studies have to be done very carefully.
Right. Now, of course, if they were able to do this in the current outbreak, this could lay the groundwork for a vaccine, if I understand the science correctly. Is that right?
I'm not sure I would agree with that. I think the vaccine research is coming from a different angle, and I'm not really you know, very experienced in the vaccinology, but the vaccines that are under development or that are actually currently being tested in safety trials have been in development for a long time without really any regards to thinking about asymptomatically developed immunity.
Sounds like where we are right now is we have sort of hints, suggestions, and sort of wisps of information that are leading down this scientific hypothesis or query about asymptomatic Ebola. In other words, we've not yet stuck the landing. There's a long way to go.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think it's extremely suggestive. What we now need to do is we need to do some sort of study to figure out how common it is in these outbreak settings. And then we need to really gain some traction on whether it actually confers immunity.
Steve Bellin, a researcher at the University of Texas at Austin, recently co-authored a study published in the Lancet Journal on asymptomatic Ebola infection. In a passionate speech in Washington, Britain's Prince William made a plea for the world to do more to tackle wildlife poaching and link the problem to terrorism. As Henry Ridgewell reports from London, the prince has long held an interest in conservation. He proposed to Kate Middleton while on a holiday in a Kenyan game reserve.
Illegal poaching for products like rhino horn and ivory has driven many iconic species close to extinction. In South Africa, conservationists say a record 1,020 rhinos have been killed in 2014 alone. The total population for the whole of Africa is estimated at just over 5,000. In his speech Monday, Prince William announced the formation of a task force to combat the trade.
Specifically designed to work with the transport industry, from airlines to shipping lines, to examine its role in the illegal wildlife trade and identify means by which the sector can break the chain between suppliers and consumers.
The prince accused organized criminals of looting the planet to feed what he called mankind's ignorant craving for exotic pets, trinkets, cures and ornaments.
Criminal gangs turn vast profits from the illegal killing or capture of wildlife. Armed groups and terrorists swap poached ivory for guns, and middlemen oil the wheels of the trade in return for reward.
That link between poaching and armed groups and terrorists is gaining increasing attention. In Kenya in recent weeks, Islamist Al-Shabaab militants based in Somalia have killed dozens of Kenyans in attacks on a bus and on non-Muslims working in a quarry. At a recent conference on conservation and security, Kenya's Secretary of State for the Environment, Judy Wakungu, said the two issues can be viewed through the same policy lens.
We share some very sensitive borders with countries such as Somalia, South Sudan, Ethiopia. Some of these problems have meant that we have faced increased levels of terrorism. And we do think that there is a connection to increased poaching.
The fledgling concept of treating security threats and poaching as problems with similar policies has become known as stablecon, stabilization through conservation. Indigenous populations are central, explains the brainchild of stablecon, Ian Saunders, founder of the Kenyan Tsavo Trust.
To work at a human level, to provide an area that is conducive to both wildlife and humans into perpetuity, is vital for the stabilization of Kenya and the future of Kenya and the future of many other countries.
Africa's wildlife draws millions of tourists, but Saunders argues that wildlife must be protected for reasons beyond tourism and that conservation can bring security. With poaching expanding at an alarming rate, the search for a solution is becoming ever more urgent. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Australia has pledged $165 million to a United Nations fund that helps poor nations combat climate change. One of the world's worst polluters per capita, Australia has been under international pressure to donate to the UN Green Climate Fund. Prime Minister Tony Abbott has been reluctant to do so, saying his government was taking its own steps to improve the environment. But Mr. Abbott reversed course today, saying the money will be dispersed over 4 years and will come from the foreign aid budget. Thank you for joining us today for our International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On December 10th, 1520, German monk Martin Luther publicly burned the papal edict demanding that he recant his call for changes in Roman Catholic doctrine and practice. Luther began the Protestant Reformation in Europe, which contributed to the spread of the ideals of freedom and liberty that endure to this day. On this day in 1799, the French government formally adopted the metric system, a means of measurement based on the decimal system. It was not widely accepted at first, but today it is the main measurement language for much of the world. On this day in 1815, Ada Lovelace, the daughter of British poet Lord Byron, was born. Her mother, a noted mathematician, taught her math and science. As an adult, she collaborated with Charles Babbage on the first mechanical calculating machine. She was later credited with developing the first computer program. On this day in 1869, the American territory Wyoming granted women the right to vote and hold public office. On this date in 1902, women were also granted the right to vote in Tasmania. In 1949, the Communist People's Liberation Army began its siege of Chengdu, the last nationalist-held city on mainland China, forcing the government to retreat to Taiwan. On this day in 1963, Frank Sinatra Jr., the kidnapped son of the American actor and singer, was allowed to talk to his father briefly. The 19-year-old Sinatra was later released and his captors put on trial. In 1989, Sakya Elbegdorj announced the establishment of Mongolia's democratic movement. Eventually, the second oldest communist country in the world was transformed into a democracy. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States strongly condemns the barbaric murder of Luke Summers at the hands of al-Qaeda terrorists during a rescue operation conducted by U.S. forces in Yemen in partnership with the Yemeni government. On behalf of the American people, said President Barack Obama, I offer my deepest condolences to Luke's family and to his loved ones. In addition, the president extended his condolences to the family of Pierre Corky, the South African citizen who was also murdered by these terrorists during the rescue operation. It is the President of the United States' highest responsibility to do everything possible to protect American citizens. As this rescue operation demonstrates, the United States will spare no effort to use all of its military, intelligence, and diplomatic capabilities to bring Americans home safely wherever they are located. Luke Summers was kidnapped 15 months ago in Yemen and held hostage by al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, or AQAP. Since his capture, the United States has been using every tool at its disposal to secure his release. Recent intelligence indicated that Luke's life was in imminent danger. Based on this assessment, President Obama authorized a rescue attempt of Mr. Summers, in addition to the rescue of any other hostages held in the same location as Luke. Mr. Summers was a photojournalist who sought through his images to convey the lies of Yemenis to the outside world. He came to Yemen in peace and was held against his will and threatened by a despicable terrorist organization. The callous disregard for Mr. Summers' life is more proof of the depths of AQAP's depravity and further reason why the world must never cease in seeking to defeat their evil ideology. The United States remembers the Summers family as well as the families of those Americans who are still being held captive overseas and those who have lost loved ones to the brutality of these and other terrorists. We remain determined to do our utmost to bring them home, said President Obama, and to hold those who have done them harm accountable.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.